Famously, there are seven I am statements. I'll make the statement that there are at least eight. Okay? There are at least eight. And following up on the last time I stood in this pulpit, we talked about passion, which breeds purity, which breeds power. And I was thinking about the passion part. I said, you know, what breeds passion? Knowing breeds passion. You know, there's got to be a level of intimacy, a level of knowledge, and what better way to know about a person or to know a person is to know what they say about themselves. So what better authority on knowing Jesus is there than Jesus, right? So I'm going to share with you this morning. If you want to follow along, we'll be in the book of John virtually the entire morning, but we're going to be jumping from chapter to chapter. We're going to start in chapter 6. Am I a little hot, guys? Yeah. Okay. In John chapter 6, it starts off with, this incident follows the feeding of the 5,000. And, you know, obviously there's been a big crowd there, and Jesus multiplies miraculously a very small amount of food to feed a very big crowd. And in verse 22 of chapter 6, it starts off that on the following day, when the people who were standing on the other side of the sea saw that there was no other boat there, except the one which his disciples entered. Actually, that's the wrong verse, but that's okay. The crowd follows Jesus. Why did the crowd follow Jesus? Well, I'm sure some of them were interested in what he had to say. Others, however, were probably attracted by the miracle. They wanted to see, could he feed them again? What more extraordinary thing could he do? What in the world is this Jesus going to do next? Let's go see the show. Maybe it'll benefit us. It did yesterday. So the crowd comes along, and we actually get to verse 30 of chapter 6, and it says, Therefore they said to him, what sign will you perform then that we may see it and believe you? What work will you do? Our fathers ate manna in the desert. As it is written, he gave them bread from heaven to eat. Well, that reveals their motivation right there, doesn't it? You know, they're looking for something miraculous. They want to see a sign. They want Jesus to do something extraordinary again. And Jesus said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, Moses did not give you the bread from heaven, but my Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world. Then they said to him, Lord, give us this bread always. Well, what they missed there was that last part. The bread of God is he who comes from heaven and gives life to the world. Well, that's not physical bread, is it? That's a different kind of bread. That's a kind of bread that they weren't anticipating. And the crowd, doing what crowds do, really doesn't understand what they've asked for, but they ask for that bread. Well, he's going to reveal to them what that bread is. And Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me shall never hunger, and he who believes in me shall never thirst. But I say to you that you have seen me and yet do not believe. I am the bread of life, Jesus says. Well, what's bread? Bread is a grain and a few other additives, and it's all mixed together, and when you get done with it, it creates a food substance, right? But that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is this, is it represents all food. It represents all sustenance. The bread of life is that which sustains life. Physical bread sustains physical life. We've all seen the clips that they show us on TV when they're doing drives to prevent hunger. And we've seen that little clip of film where this small starving child is grasping just this portion of a slice of bread, and it's like the best thing that they've ever seen. Well, in that case, it might be, because that might be the thing that preserves their physical life. When we look at it as the sustenance that we need, then we've got to take it to another level. It's physical, but even more so, it's spiritual. Jesus as bread provides what we need. As that physical bread provides physical nutrients to sustain a physical body, the only thing that provides the spiritual nutrient to sustain the soul is what Jesus can provide. He says here that He is the bread. He says that that is what God gave, right? Now, we find out later, as Jesus interprets some things that are going to happen in the last week of His life, that He says that basically His body is bread, which is broken for you. Not physically, not that we would literally consume Him, but that it is needful that His body be broken in order for us to receive the sustenance that we need. Jesus is bread. We cannot live spiritually without Him. The man without Christ, the woman without Christ, is dead in sin. There is no life there, spiritually speaking. It takes only the bread that is Christ in order to create and sustain that life. We must be born again, and we must feed on what He provides. So that is one of the I ams of Jesus. We go on chapter 8, and Jesus is on the Mount of Olives, and He's teaching. And this follows another incident, which is, well, rather disturbing, actually. Trying to tempt Jesus, they bring to Him a woman who was, quote, caught in the very act of adultery, end quote. Well, I think it takes two. Where was He? You know, we don't have that indication. But what goes on here is this. You know, Jesus goes and He basically doesn't act when they ask Him what to do. They're trying to trap Him. They're trying to drive a wedge between His teaching and the crowd. And they want Him to either stand for the law of Moses and say she must be stoned, or they want Him to give her a pass so that they can point their finger and say, aha, He doesn't stand for the law of Moses. Therefore, He can't be from God. Jesus does something extraordinary. He says nothing and starts scribbling in the sand. Lots of speculation as to what He might have done there. But the end of the story is this. He says, whoever hasn't sinned, cast the first stone. What happens to the crowd? They start dwindling away. The accusers begin to drop their rocks and wander off, beginning with the oldest and down to the youngest, which is an interesting story because apparently the older folks have a longer list of things to eliminate them from casting that first stone. But all the people walk away, and Jesus asks the woman, where are your accusers? Lord, they're gone. Neither do I accuse you. Go and sin no more. Immediately following this, Jesus looks up at the crowd who's watched this whole episode. Jesus spoke to them saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. This is an interesting context to put this statement. One assumes that the act of adultery that we just talked about was probably done in darkness. It was certainly something that was being hidden because it was against the law of Moses and flew in the face of the conventions of society. But Jesus says he's the light. Let's think about what light is. The main function of light is to dispel darkness. Darkness cannot overcome light, but light can overcome darkness. A speck of light in a dark void can be seen. Okay? A speck of dark in bright light cannot be seen. Okay? So light dispels darkness. Well, anybody ever been in the woods at night and trying to go someplace in the woods at night? What do? You take a flashlight, and where do you shine that flashlight? In the direction you're going, but even more specifically than that, at the ground in the direction you're going. Why do you do that? So you don't trip over something, right? So light dispels darkness, but it can also prevent stumbling. It can prevent falling. It can prevent injuring yourself. Okay. We've all seen the movies and what have you, and someone's trapped in a place, and all of a sudden, finally, they see in the distance a little speck of light. And what do? They run to the light. They run to the light. Because the light, presumably, is a place of safety. It's a place of refuge. It's a place where you can get out of the trouble you're in. Biblically speaking, the light is the truth. The truth is shown in the Word, right? By the way, what do you need to read the Word? Light. You need light to read, right? But if the light illuminates truth, it also does something else. It exposes falsehood. So if Jesus is the light of the world, then built into Him, into what He is the ability to dispel darkness, to prevent you from stumbling and falling, or at least assist you. You know, you can shine the light on the path and see the root and still trip over it if you're not careful. You do have to be careful. He's a place of safety to run to. And what He can do is illuminate the truth, which is Himself. In that way, He can also expose the falsehood. We carry around within us the truth of Christ mixed with the falsehood of the world. It gets on us. You can take a shower this morning and go out and work in the garden, and you come back with dirt on you. Doesn't change essentially who you are, but you do need to wash the dirt off. Spiritually speaking, if we're right with Christ, we carry around within us the truth of Christ, the light of Christ in us, but we go out among the world and every so often our lens gets dirty. We need to be cleansed. We need to be washed. The truth needs to come. Now, any of you ladies have a makeup mirror at the house? I see a few hands moving. Now, what is the defining characteristic of a makeup mirror? How about some bright lights? And sometimes it magnifies a little bit so you can find that little speck. You do that so that you're sure that you look your best when you go out. Well, the intensity of the light in that makeup mirror really shows up whatever little problems there might be there. The intensity of the light that Jesus brings to us illuminates whatever needs to get gone. Oh, wait a minute. There's a speck right here. That need to get rid of that. Right? Where did that come from? If you're a guy, every once in a while you look and you've got one hair in your eyebrow that's about 8 feet long and 3 feet thick, or so it seems, you know. You know, where does that stuff come from? I don't know where that stuff comes from. But, you know, it's like, ooh, that's bad. Clip the thing off. Okay. So Jesus is the light. He enables us to see what we're doing here. John chapter 10, starting at verse 7, Jesus said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, I am the door of the sheep." King James may say gate. That's New King James. "All who ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. Anyone who enters by me, he will be saved, and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief does not come except to steal, kill, and destroy. I have come that they may have life and have it abundantly." Jesus says, "I am the door." But more specifically, "I am the door of the sheep." What does that mean? Well, what's the function of a door? A door controls entry, right? It permits some people to come in, or some creatures to come in, some creatures to stay out. It also is specifically here for the sheep, so the context is it's not for the wolves, or it's not for the bears, or it's not for the lions. It's not for the thieves. The door is for the sheep. Well, in all of our symbology, the sheep are the people of God, right? So Jesus says, "I am the door for the sheep." Well, what does that mean? Well, he controls who comes in and who comes out. He allows his sheep in. But by the same token, if the wolf's coming, he'll close the door and keep the wolf on the outside. It's got to be that way. It's for entry. It allows us to come in, but it also is something that keeps us safe. It keeps the enemy at bay. So Jesus is able to both allow in his sheep and exclude those who would destroy his sheep. This is an important distinction. This is something that we need to grasp here. His sheep know his voice. His sheep, he knows by sight. You know, in the ancient times there, you know, a lot of times the sheep would be pasturing together. They, you know, mine and Shane's and Richard's, all of our sheep are out in the same field. And theoretically, my sheep will follow my voice back to my sheepfold. And Shane's will follow his voice back to his. And Richard's will follow his back to his. But, you know, every once in a while you get there and say, "Well, that's Shane's sheep. Shane's sheep needs to go home. You know, it's not one of mine." So the selective part is there, but the idea is, why are sheep in a sheepfold anyway? Keep the predators at bay. Now I'm going to go on. He goes right after this passage. He has another one of his I ams, and it goes along with it. "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But a hireling who's not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees. The wolf catches the sheep and scatters them, and the hireling flees because he's a hireling and does not care about the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my sheep and am known by my own. As my Father knows me, even so I know the Father. I lay down my life for the sheep. And other sheep I have which are not of this fold, them also I must bring. As they hear my voice, there will be one flock and one shepherd." What does a shepherd do for his sheep? He feeds them, right? He provides them what they need. He waters them. When they are sick or injured, he heals them. And he protects them. all of this is an important picture for us here of the watch care that Christ exercises over us. He is saying, my function is to be to you as a shepherd. Differentiates here between the shepherd being the one that owns the sheep and the hireling who's working for wages. If you're working for wages and a pack of wolves shows up, I'm out of here. I'm not going to risk myself for sheep that I don't own. That's the difference that he paints here in this picture. And the good shepherd, those are his sheep. He's going to put himself between the sheep and the danger. He's not going to let this attack from the enemy destroy that which is his. Therefore, he'll put himself at risk in order to protect them. That's what Jesus does for us. We'll tie this all together in a minute. Chapter 11. Chapter 11 is, as we get down to the middle verses, Lazarus has died. And Jesus is coming to the area where Martha and Mary are. And they're obviously distraught. Their brother's dead. He's been buried. He's in the tomb. And in their mind, maybe Jesus could have done something about that if he'd only been there sooner. So he comes in, and in verse 20 of chapter 11, Martha went to him weeping. And then Martha says to Jesus, Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Hint, hint. And Martha said, and Jesus said, your brother will rise again. Martha said, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection in the last day. And Jesus says one of the most extraordinary things that he says in his entire ministry. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, shall he live. Whoever lives and believes shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world. Resurrection power. Resurrection power is not something Jesus has. It is something Jesus is. It is inherent in his makeup. Jesus, as God, has the creative force of God in him. Remember the John passage I read in the beginning of the service? Everything that was made through him. Jesus is the Word. God spoke the Word, and through the Word, creation came to be. Everything that was made through him. Creative power is in him inherently as part of his godhood. So as that being the case, resurrection power is also in him. Jesus was not raised from the dead. Jesus raised from the dead. Do you understand the difference? It was not an external force that reanimated the body of Jesus. It was Jesus who reanimated the body himself. The stone wasn't rolled away to let the power of God in. The stone had to roll away to let the power of God out. See, that's the thing. It's inherent in him. Resurrection and life is part and parcel of who he is. You know, eternal life and abundant life, both are part of that picture. Well, what's the difference? We use them interchangeably sometimes. Eternal means forever, right? So eternal life, existence throughout all time, is part and parcel of who Jesus is. But he promises us abundant life. Well, what does abundant life mean? It means life filled full. It is that which enables us to have a level of satisfaction while still having a level of hunger. All right? I'm satisfied, but I want more. I'm content with what Christ has done to me, but I'm not content with staying where I am because I want more. I want another helping. Sorry, I got to fix this. It may ramble a while. All right. I'll take you now to John 14, another one of Jesus' I ams. Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe in me also. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. I go to prepare a place for you, and if I go to prepare a place for you, I'll come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And where you go, and where I go, you know the way. And the way you know. That is hard to read. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. By the way, you know what that first part of that chapter is about? It's a wedding metaphor. Okay? In Jesus' day, a man would be betrothed to a wife, and they would have an initial ceremony, but they would not come together as yet. She remained in her parents' house, and the man went home to prepare a place. Many times it was a room in his father's house, and he went to prepare the bridal chamber. And what would happen is, at a particular time, when his father told him the time was right, that the chamber was ready, then he would go and get his bride. Okay? And this is a metaphor. Jesus says he's gone to prepare a place for us. He's gone back to his father's house to prepare a bridal chamber for us. Anybody notice the new piece of art in the front foyer this morning? Did you notice the lion has a crown? That's a Jerusalem of gold crown, and it figures in the wedding ceremony. Typically the bride wore it, but it's a picture of an upcoming wedding when we, the church, the bride of Christ, will be taken home to the place that the bridegroom, who is Jesus, has prepared. If that don't get you excited, I don't know what will. Okay. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. What is the way? Well, the way is a path. Melinda was talking about using the GPS there to track her journey the other day. You know, why do you call that thing up? So it gives you directions. It gives you turn-by-turn directions. And amazingly enough, if you take the wrong turn, it tells you how to correct it, theoretically. If it knows that the interstate's closed in downtown Birmingham, which the one I had didn't. It's a story for another time. Jesus, however, knows when the road's closed. Okay. He knows the way. He himself prepares for us a path. There is a path that each of us will walk. Jesus knows which steps we'll take and which missteps we'll take. He knows how to get us to our destination, and he knows how to correct us when we get off course. We need to listen to him better than we listen to that little box. We need to follow that way. He is our guide. You know, if you go into the North Woods someplace to go on a hunting expedition, you'll hire a guide usually. Why do you do that? Because he knows the area, he knows what the dangers are, and he knows where you're likely to find what you're looking for. And he will take you step by step to get where you need to go. Jesus says He is the way. He not only knows the path, He is the path. He's the truth. The truth is the Word. The Word is Jesus. Right? So He is the reality behind whatever we see in this physical realm. The truth in the physical realm and the truth in the spiritual realm sometimes don't line up. Matter of fact, pretty often they don't line up. Jesus is able to show us the truth in the spiritual realm to help us guide our path in the physical realm. We've probably all had the experience of being someplace and we know we need to go over there, but we can't see how to get there. You know, we're here and there's a barrier. There's something that prevents us from seeing our final destination. We know we're close to it, but we can't get there. I remember when my kids were little, we would occasionally go to Cincinnati and go to the zoo, and we wanted to go to a particular museum one time while we were there. And with all the one-way streets in downtown Cincinnati, I could see it, but I couldn't drive to it. I went all over downtown. Never did get there, by the way. I finally got mad and gave up. But, you know, but here's the thing. If I'd had that GPS at the time, I might have figured out how to get there. But you see, you've got a different perspective. If you're looking down on that city and see all the roads and the one-way signs, you can pretty much figure out how to get where you're going. If you're sitting in a car in a traffic jam, you can't see much, can you? So the truth sometimes is the perspective that you can't see. We see obstacles in our lives and think that they're obstacles. Jesus can see those same obstacles and see that this is a learning experience. This is something that Zita has to get through because she's going to need this knowledge next week, next month, next year. We don't have that perspective. All we see is there's a mountain in front of me and I can't get around it. Well, you may not be supposed to get around it. You may be supposed to go over top of it. You may be supposed to move it. But you see, we can't see that. Jesus can. That's where the truth comes in. Also says He's the life. He's the way, He's the truth, and He's the life. Eternal and abundant, filled full. That kind of summarizes that previous one. For He's the resurrection and the life. He's the way, the truth, and the life. Life keeps coming up. We're very well educated in this century. We've got all sorts of scientists and all sorts of laboratories. But there's one thing we can't create. We can't create life. We can clone life, but that's not creating life. We can biologically make life, but that's not creating life. There's something you can't explain scientifically, and that is the spark that creates a living creature, particularly a living creature with a soul. Genesis, however, explains that. When God breathed the breath of life into Adam, only He can create life in that way. Number 7. Getting into John 15, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. And then down in verse 5, He says, I am the vine, and you're the branches. He who abides in me and I in him bears much fruit, but without me you can do nothing. What's the function of a vine? Well, Let's think about a plant. You got a plant, it's got a root. The root connects the plant to the ground, where it receives the nutrients and the water and what have you that it needs to survive. The root connects the vine to the source. The vine, being the main stem, then transmits what the root gives it up to the point that it starts to branch out. And when it begins to branch out, those branches, their function is to bear fruit. In Jesus' day, and something that they would be very familiar with, you had a couple of things. You had olive trees and you had grapevines that were very common sights to everyone. But very often what you would see, and you can still see it today, if you go into a vineyard today that's been in existence for many years, you may see a rootstock and a main stem that's 100 years old or older. It's established. But what happens when the vines, when the branches on the vine begin to not be fruitful, the vine dresser prunes them off and grafts a new one in. And when it ceases to be fruitful, he'll prune it off and graft a new one in. The vine remains. The branches are for a season. The function of the vine is to provide everything the branches need so that the branches can perform their function, which is to bear fruit. Well, this is something that I said, well, they would have been very, very familiar in Jesus' day, much less now. So the vine sprouts from the root, which is connected to the source. It provides the nourishment and stability to the branches and enables the growth and production of the fruit. Now, Jesus says he's the vine. God the Father being the source, he takes everything that is necessary and brings it up for the benefit of the branches, which is us, so that we can bear fruit. He provides everything necessary. We, out of a natural, this is it, you know, the branches don't create the fruit. The branches don't cause the fruit to happen. The branches bear the fruit. It's their natural condition. It's just what they do. As long as they're connected to the vine, they bear fruit. So, it's not our deal to make it happen. It's our deal to let it happen. Let what Jesus says come true. Told you what I heard this morning. I heard I am. Back up to John chapter 8 for a minute, where he says this. Jesus is being accused of expelling demons by the power of demons. And he basically says, I don't have a demon, I honor my Father. You dishonor me. And there's a whole exchange. And Jesus says to them, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. He saw it and was glad. Now we've got him. So you're not even 50 years old. You know, have you seen Abraham? And Jesus said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. I am. This I am includes and summarizes all of the others. Because you see, that's not the first time that's been heard. If we back up a little bit, we go back to the book of Exodus in chapter 3. God has gotten Moses' attention by an extraordinary event. A bush which burns and is not consumed by fire, and is in the midst of trying to convince Moses to do what he's supposed to do. Did I say Abraham a minute ago? If I didn't, I meant Moses. God's trying to convince Moses what to do. And Moses is protesting very much that you need to call somebody else, not me. I'm not capable, God do it with somebody else. He says, okay, if I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what's his name? What shall I say? And God said to Moses, Eyah Asher Eyah, I am who I am. I am that I am. I am who I may be. There is no real tense to that statement in the Hebrew. I am who I am. Thus shall you say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. In this one statement, Jesus expresses his Godhood more eloquently than he does every place else. He gives us details, he gives us glimpses, he gives us bits and pieces. But at the end of the day, when he says, I am, in the same way his father said, I am to Moses, he is expressing who he is. We've said all this to come to this point. If we want to have passion for Jesus, it's important that we know who he is. And the best source for knowing who he is what he says about himself. The question is, does any of that excite you? Does any of that stir something in you? Does any of that make you want to share it with somebody else? If we're going to have passion for Jesus, we need to spend enough time to understand who he is and what that means to us. What does it mean to have I am living in me? What does it mean to have I am living in you? Do you need more life? The source is in you. Do you feel like you're not bearing fruit? You're connected to the vine. Do you feel like you need light to quit stumbling around in the darkness? If you've given your heart to Christ, it's already in you. That light is in you. Well, what's preventing it from shining? It's got to be decisions we've made. It's got to be running and hiding instead of confronting that which challenges us. It's got to be allowing the darkness to collect until we've covered the light up to where it can't shine. What do you need today? If you're a child of God, it's already in you. We just got to let it out. I find myself lacking sometimes in the passion. I know the truth. I know that Christ is in me. I know that the power to overcome any challenge is already in there. But there are days the weight of the world and the problems of daily life just weigh on you so hard that you don't let that shine through. And I'm pretty sure that if I feel that way, some of you do too. I'm pretty sure that there are days when you feel defeated and you feel like that there's just no way to persevere. But what this word says and what I am living in you says is it doesn't have to be that way. Sometimes we may have to go over the mountain instead of around it. sometimes we may have to blast a hole right through the middle of it. But if the path, if the way to the truth and the light is on the other side, then we got to get around it, over it, through it, whatever's necessary. If we want to be all we can be in Christ and help others to find that truth, then we need to get with the program. We need to let the light shine through us. We need to let the life flow through us. We need to bear fruit. So I'm going to ask you this morning, if you have any needs, come to this altar this morning. First and foremost, if you don't know Christ as Savior, none of this applies. But it can. Simple decision to give your life to Him. If that's what you need to do this morning, come and see me directly. Otherwise, the altars are open for prayer.